This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
It's my pleasure to introduce our next speaker. Bless you. Tracy Trotter, who is a well-known pediatrician who's practiced pediatrics in San Ramon for 34 years. He tells me that he's actually going to retire, but I don't believe it. And several years ago, he decided to make his practice more interesting, and he's going to tell us about that. He currently serves as chair of the Council on Genetics of the American Academy of Pediatrics, which is an honor rarely bestowed upon someone in general pediatrics. It's usually somebody who's a genetic researcher. So Dr. Trotter is really very well qualified in that area. He has many publications in the field of genetics as well as primary care, and he's received numerous awards and honors for his work with children, with a special focus on children with special needs. So welcome to the podium, Tracy. Dr. Trotter, thank you.
Thank you, Lucy. Kathleen, that was a great talk. I really enjoyed that. And I totally agree with your son regarding bacon. Yeah. We'll get along just fine. So my goal today is to give you a little insight into providing primary care as a pediatrician to a large group of children with special health care needs, especially Down syndrome, it turns out, is a very special interest of mine. Hopefully to intrigue you that it's worthwhile to do that and to give you some resources to do that and talk a little bit about some of the issues that will likely come up. So first is I'm sort of sad to say I have no financial disclosures, but there you go. A little bit about my background, our practice in San Ramon. Tom Long and I were solo practitioners who put it together in 1982, developed San Ramon Valley Primary Care. The last year I was full-time in the office was 2015, and we had 10 pediatric providers and 7 adult providers at that point, doing pretty much just general medical care. My interest in medical genetics goes back to somewhat fortunate set of circumstances in the late 70s, early 80s. I was teaching at St. Joseph's Hospital in Phoenix, which became Phoenix Children's Hospital, that program, the year I left. I don't think it was related to me leaving, but. And there was, in those years, there was not a board-certified medical geneticist in the state of Arizona. So I was interested, wasn't trained. I had done some mini fellowship stuff at LA Children's as a favor to my mentor, actually, and but I was interested, and so I became in charge of that in Phoenix for about 4 or 5 years, which was luckily run by a large committee of very smart people who helped me out, but it really sort of threw me into the deep end of the pool. But I stayed interested, got involved in the March of Dimes Foundation, which is a fabulous organization, I might add. Had the great opportunity in 1997 to serve on the National Committee on Genetics of the American Academy of Pediatrics. They came up with this crazy rule in 1997 that every standing committee should have one member who is actually seeing patients. You may or may not be surprised how hard it was for them to find people for some of these committees, but it was a great introduction for me, and since then I've had some other opportunities that have really allowed me to stay interested while I'm doing my practice of general pediatrics at the same time. My specific incident of Down syndrome can be traced to a single patient, Josie. Josie was born in 1978. It was the first year I was teaching, actually. Her mom was a pediatric physical therapist in our hospital and a good friend. Mom was 25 years old, and this was a total surprise. And she asked me to see Josie, and I did, and she was a cute little baby who had Down syndrome. And I have stayed in contact, took care of her all the years I was there, stayed in contact, and 3 weeks from today, I'll be having lunch with her in Phoenix. She's now 38 years old, lives in a semi-independently in a group home in Tempe, Arizona, and works at Albertsons. And she has going to have lunch off on that day for Albertsons, and we're going to go to lunch. So it really gave me a very positive introduction to something that I knew something about, but I didn't really know about, because only parents and patients know about those things. When I moved here, one of the first people to find me was a very interesting lady named Virginia Pierce. She had a grandson who had Down syndrome, and she had decided that his life would have whatever the maximum it could have, and she was going to see to that. And by God, I tell you what, you wouldn't get in her way when she was trying to do that. And she was the instigator of the Down Syndrome League of the East Bay a few years before I moved here. And I worked with her and served on the board of that until the mid-90s, when the Down Syndrome Connection, basically it morphed into that sort of bigger organization, which Kathleen just talked about, which is, I will give them their due. That is a fantastic organization, as you can see all the things they provide. And then I've had a couple of opportunities to work on the American Academy of Pediatrics health supervision guidelines for children with Down syndrome, once in 2001, and currently we're revising again, and that really has been a great way to tune up academically on what's going on out there. So whenever you talk about providing primary care to a group of patients who have any special health care needs, the concept of a medical home, which I suspect is something that probably everybody in this room understands better than most physicians do, is critical. And not only does it have, you know, these typical seven attributes that are always noted here, but it's a process. It's not just a place. It is, and emphasize the word home, it's a headquarters for care for people who often have complicated care plans. It's a place where they feel individually recognized, individually welcome. They are my patient. They're just not another patient with Down syndrome or whatever they might have. And so you're part of the community of services that these patients receive. And as you know, the typical patient with a developmental disability is, of all the services they receive, frequently the least important one is their direct medical care. And it's frequently the least amount of minutes they will spend in any given year, unless they're going through something like heart surgery or something like that. But you still need a quarterback. And so I will add the concept of a great medical home says you know the needs of the patients in your practice, whether they have a specific diagnosis like Down syndrome or more generally in dealing with, and I think this is extremely more important when dealing with children and youth with special health care needs. You are a partner with the family and youth. That is, to me, one of the most critical issues here, and we'll talk about it a little bit more with the next slide or two. You need to use a proactive approach to chronic condition management instead of responding to crises, and that's one of the beauties of a known disease like Down syndrome. We actually know a lot about it. And allows you to actually be, I don't know, I'm always smarter when I know what I'm supposed to look for and when I'm supposed to look. I think that works. You need to be connected to your community and to the organizations. Being connected with this community in this room, for instance, is the ideal connection for somebody who's doing something like this, because those are the experts that you will need at some point to provide the care your patients need. Having said that, pediatric primary care is not designed for that. It's designed for the 80% of children who do not have special health care needs, at least not obvious ones. I always tell parents that. We all have special needs. We just don't know what they are sometimes. It's really designed very well for providing well child preventive health care and acute illness management. And we're good at that. It is how we pay the bills. It's how we can send the kids to college, things like that. But it is what we're really trained to do, what we spend years getting trained to do, is really not that. We're the 20%, or in my case it was 55% the last year I was in full-time practice, who our special health care needs are the patients who most benefit from your training, your expertise, and your experience. They are the people who really need it. They are the people who benefit the most. And it will enhance your practice. It will make your career more satisfying. They, as I look back over a lot of years of doing it, they are the highlights of my practice time. So why Down syndrome, and how can that happen that makes sense? Because frequently when I talk to young pediatricians or trainees, they'll say, well, geez, I might see one or two in my lifetime. How can I be any good at that? And, you know, shouldn't they all go to a Down syndrome clinic somewhere? Well, we live in an area where you actually probably could do that if you don't mind driving a little bit. You could go there, but most of the parts of the United States, you're not going to be able to do that. Most square states don't have anything at all. So we need the primary care docs to step up to this. So I always point out that this is a disorder that we have a very reasonable understanding of the natural history, the likely clinical issues, when they tend to occur, timing of onset. We know that medical management, home environment, early intervention, and education significantly impact the quality of lives for these children and their families. So there is a difference to be made if you are up front making that difference. And there are people out there trying to help us. The AAP guidelines, which we're going to talk about a little bit more in a few minutes, because they're near and dear to my heart, and so I'll try to sell them a little bit to you. There's also a group called the Down Syndrome Medical Interest Group, which I also belong to. It's a very loose organization of medical professionals. It's both national and local. And Lucy is actually a member of our local group here. That gets together to discuss and look at research and look at best practices, and in the past has come up with healthcare guidelines as well. And I'm happy to say that 2016, for the first time in 20 years, the two sets of guidelines actually agreed with each other, which was I didn't think would ever happen. So anyway, that's a good thing. So what are the advantages that I have in my practice to taking care of these relatively unique patients that most pediatricians would say? First, I think the normalization of any special needs patients is a critical part of what you do in practice. And Kathleen said it more eloquently than I will, and I really just will say take to heart what she has to say. These are kids who are cute kids, who are sometimes a pain in the ass, and sometimes they're not, and they're brothers and sisters, and they're all these other things. They happen to have a diagnosis that we have to deal with, yes. But when you're being seen by your general pediatrician, you're just a kid in the practice. When you're being seen at the Down syndrome clinic, guess what? You have Down syndrome. It doesn't mean that's a bad thing. It just means it's an advantage, I think, that I have. In terms of this, and I always point out to people, 90% of the things you will see me for in your lifetime, in 20 years, is not going to have much to do with Down syndrome. It's going to have to do with the fact you have a kid. And kids get, you know, ear infections. Yeah, they get them a little more frequently if they have Down syndrome, but guess what? Anybody who's got kids has probably had some with an ear infection. And they have, you know, problems at school, and they have this and that and the other thing. These are kid things. And I have the ability in my setting sort of make it sound that way and look that way. These families all need a quarterback, captain. They are frequently their own quarterback, which actually works amazingly well considering that they have to all be self-trained to make that happen. But they could sure use a professional quarterback, just like the 49ers could. We're hoping the draft's coming. So, if you realize these folks are often hooked up with, I think the average 1 year when I looked at this for a school-age child with Down syndrome is they had eight different providers of something that was helping them deal with it. And if you start adding up what all those eight providers have in mind for you to do with your child, And I make people do this. I have to write it out and the number of hours a week they're supposed to do it. It usually comes out to around 26 and a half hours a day of activities. So you can't sleep, you can't eat, and you can't be a kid. So somebody has to prioritize that, because all of the things probably are important, but not all at the same time and not all in the same way. So I have this great ability, and I think this is probably the key play here, is to transmit and repeat and transmit and repeat information a little at a time over a long time frame. You know, built into my first 2 years is 12 routine well visits. So that's about every other month we get a chance to talk about something. And how many people have forgotten what you told them last month? Yeah, everyone, pretty much. So you get to do it again, and you get to clarify it, and you get to tweak it, and more importantly is you get to know the family. So you know how much or how little information they need and how specific and how general you can be. Some people are pretty self-sufficient. They just need a little nudge, right? Others, not so much. But as you know that, you can tailor sort of how you do that. Something that I find, I do consultations also with some frequency, and I find it very difficult to do in that situation. I sort of have to do everything because I don't know where you are and how much you know. And you also get a chance to point out the positives. Kathleen pointed this out very much. I mean, it's, again, in a consultation, you're tending to look at the problem and then try to put some Band-Aids on all the problems and talk about that. But if you're just, you know, being seen for your nine-month visit, you can point out how cute she looks and, wow, she rolled over already. That's pretty early for, you know, she's ahead of the curve there. Or she's been unusually healthy, but this is one we haven't seen you a lot. And all those things, again, humanize, quote, normalize, and I think really help parents a lot in terms of dealing with this. Which brings us to the most important partnership of all for children with special health care needs. I'm going to tailor this to Down syndrome, but it's true with all. So we need a team of experts. We need a village to raise a child. We need a team of experts to care for all children. There's no question about that. But children with special needs have way more experts. So, a typical school-age kid will have a pediatrician who I sort of tell parents, we are your medical and developmental experts. That's our expertise, and we can probably help answer questions about those things and hopefully give you proactive advice about it. They'll have a 50% of them will have a cardiologist, obviously. They've either had surgery or they're being followed. 100% will have an ophthalmologist. 100% will have an education person, teacher, whatever. Pretty close to 100% will have either a speech therapist, OT, PT. Most will have all of the above. And then we haven't even added in all the extras that may come up very specifically. But the one expert that makes all the other experts work is the parent. So without an expert parent, the rest of us are just throwing out average answers that might affect an average kid if you had 100 of them and you put them in a blender, but may not affect Fred, who is a very specific kid in a specific family with specific needs. So they're the parents, they're the people, the only expert who actually knows the patient as well as none of us can even come close to that, and can either make our advice work because they help us shape it for that child, or they can make it fail, and they're really good at that too, if they think that you really don't get you don't get that kid and that family. So just a quick word about this, mostly because I wanted it in your syllabus. And I'm spending way more hundreds of hours of my life doing this than I should right now. But the Health Supervision for Children with Down Syndrome is a very, very helpful document, first written in 94 by Judy Hall and Ed McCabe. It's been revised a couple of times. I was involved in one of those I mentioned back in 2001. And we are currently just beginning. I'm co-authoring with Marilyn Bull, who is probably one of the experts in the world on medical care of children with Down syndrome. And we are revising that. A new one will be published by the end of 2017, I hope. And it is available right there. So you can just have a look at it. Any child in a pediatric practice with Down syndrome should have this in their chart or the access to it. Some EMRs will allow you to link it, and you can pop it up. I wish they all would do that, but that's pie in the sky. But a very good document to have, good to look at. It is they are designed by age. There's sort of three parts to these reports. One is a good overview, very quick overview of the disease. We have them for Down syndrome, for Williams syndrome, Turner syndrome, achondroplasia. I think we have 14 now, and we're the Council on Genetics, which I'm currently involved in, is one of our jobs is to keep producing those. But we have about five in process as well, and they really serve as somewhat of a cookbook. So if you're seeing a child at a certain age, you can just read those 10 paragraphs, and we'll tell you, here's the problems that tend to show up here, here's a good way to screen for them, to look for them, to ask questions for them, and here's how to approach it if, in fact, you find some of those things. The second thing is to talk about things that be reviewed at every well visit. I put this up here only to point out that if you look at it, it's what you should be talking to every patient about. It just becomes maybe a little more specific and a little more tuned in to the problem when you have a special needs patient, but they are the same problems. And I'm taking one age group just as an example because we don't have time to go through this completely. But from 1 month to 1 year, infancy, it says under physical testing and laboratory studies to do these things. Hearing evaluation, because 75% of children with Down syndrome will have either conductive or sensory neural loss at some point in their life. An ophthalmologist, because 15% have cataracts and 50% have refractive errors. Thyroid test, because of thyroid disease, which we'll talk about a little more next. And a CBC, because as much as 4% will have a transient myeloproliferative disorder, which is leukemia-like in the newborn period, infancy period, but goes away, thank God. But 1%, which is a very high number when you start thinking of 1 in 100 children with Down syndrome will end up with leukemia. So this is a good and easy screening device to do at least yearly, and that's the current recommendation. Under anticipatory guidance, you can see it looks sort of like you talk about the other children, growth and development. So growth and development has a lot more specific questions for patients, parents of children with Down syndrome, because when are they going to do what? And I put that chart in your syllabus as well, so you'll have that, which I think I have on the slides. Talk about intervention services. They are marvelous ways to get parents involved in doing something. And we talk a fair amount about alternative therapies, which I see Bob Herndon's going to speak today, and he's truly one of the experts in the world about those kinds of therapies in children with special needs, especially autism. So pay attention to what he has to say. I put a fair amount of information in the handout about alternative therapies. I was going to talk about it if we had time. I don't think we will, but I wanted you to see it because it comes up so frequently. Developmental milestones, this is just a little way to look at what the numbers are. And it's important to point out, yes, it is very likely that your child is going to meet all of the normal milestones at some point. The difference is when is that going to happen? How efficiently is it going to happen? As you can see, it's later, and the range is huge. But just knowing that it's out there and we can get there and we can help you get there, I think is really important. Because frequently, at the early time of early diagnosis, as Kathleen pointed out, you don't know anything and you just assume all the worst stuff. And this is a good handout to give people. Growth, one of the important reasons we're doing a new revision is because we have new growth charts. the old charts were first published in 1988. So, and these were from a CDC project with CHOP, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, in, I think, 2014-15, and published in late 2015 by the CDC. And I did put the URL on there. You can just print them. They're really quite accurate. The old ones really underestimate growth dramatically, mostly because we didn't repair all the hearts then, and we didn't repair them very well. And we really didn't have a good handle on nutrition in the first couple of years that I think we do now, and an emphasis, maybe I should say. So that's a big issue and important that you use the right growth charts. Otherwise, it doesn't make much sense. Obesity is a big issue. Tell people to follow the BMI from age 2, and it will really help you sort of keep an eye on that, because the general rule is everybody's a little chunky, and if you're hypotonic, you don't need chunky. It becomes a tremendously vicious cycle if you're not active because your tone's not very good, and then you get a little obese, so it makes it harder. So then you don't do any more, and it goes in a big bad circle. So we talk about that. Short stature is universal. It is what it is. There was a great rush in the 90s to use human growth hormone to try to fix this. And finally, the definitive study was done in Sweden, where they treated children for 5 consecutive years with Down syndrome with human growth hormone. And in fact, they doubled their velocity of growth during that time, but did not affect the end result. So the end result was already built into the system, it looks like. Getting there faster, any help? Not particularly. I don't think it is, anyway. And there is some risk, because it does stimulate growing cells, and this 1% leukemia is always out there hovering around. So the current recommendation is not actually to use human growth hormone for that. Thyroid disease, I throw up here. This is the third way that the healthcare guidelines are used. They look at a specific disease or disorder that is common, and Kathleen's outline was fabulous, by the way, of looking at all the medical issues that are found with a greater significance in children with Down syndrome. This one is interesting because it's dramatically profound. It's to 25%. It's probably even a low number. If you looked at through age 40, I think it goes up to 40%. So this is in childhood, thyroid disease in childhood. 20 genital hyperthyroidism is 28 times more frequent than in the general population. Now, everybody in the United States gets screened for that as a newborn, so thankfully that is actually fairly well covered, just because it's part of the screen in every state now. But acquired hyperthyroidism, which is can occur any time in life, is a little more common in early adolescence, but pretty much can occur any time in life. The good news is it's relatively slow onset. It has a biochemical change before a clinical change. And so screening works for it. Just once a year. Do a T4 TSH once a year. And if you get an abnormal TSH with a normal T4, sometimes called compensated hypothyroidism, you don't need to treat that, but then you have to do autoantibodies, because most of those people will have Hashimoto's thyroiditis and will eventually need to have some thyroid replacement. And you need to do this because what are the symptoms of hypothyroidism, chronic hyperthyroidism? Cognitive delay, obesity, hypotonic, dry skin, large tongue. Does this sound like anything you've seen in the last hour? So, interesting story about this is back in the 70s and 80s, there were two doctors, Turkel and Harrell, who did studies on using megavitamins in Down syndrome, and they published this positive result, which has been driving us nuts since then. Because what they did is they used a giant bunch of megavitamin doses with thyroid hormone. And this was back in the day when you gave thyroid to people who were, you know, unhappy or whatever. So they don't, you know, until you read the article carefully, you don't sort of get this. And in fact, they had a dramatic improvement in about 20% of their patients. How about that? If you give thyroid to people who have hypothyroidism, they in fact do improve. But the vitamins had nothing to do with it. So that's another story, but interesting. That was actually the importance of that study was that people who looked at it objectively said, you know what we should be doing is testing for thyroid disease. And voila. So this is just a sort of a summary going through all the different things we find at different ages and suggesting how you screen for those, and just something you should have a copy of somewhere in terms of that. These are helpful websites. The first two I put have to do with the health supervision thing and with the Down syndrome connection, because they are both dear to my heart, so they get to go first. And I don't think we have time to talk about alternative medicine, but Bob will be along in the afternoon to pick this up.
As a matter of
fact. You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.